Yes.
Some oral history interview with Fred Bosolo on 27th of September 2002. The interviewers are Arnold Thackeray and Arthur Demarish, and the focus is the Gordon Research Conferences. But Fred, we should probably actually begin with you coming to Northwestern, as you were just saying, getting into... were you aware of, as a graduate student, were you aware there was such a thing as a Gordon Research Conference before you ever came here?
No, I wasn't even aware that Northwestern existed before I came here. So, yes, if you need to know how it happened, I came here. I mentioned last night that I did my first job was to do this classified research during World War II. And as soon as the war was over, or practically over, and people like myself on these doing the classified work, most of us were free to go ahead. And I had always wanted to teach, because as an undergraduate, I went to a teacher's college where you can only get a bachelor. Well, you read my autobiography, Bachelor of Education, and I also wanted to stay in the state of Illinois, because that's where I grew up. Never again. And Northwestern, not all universities really were looking for faculty, because the GIs were coming back, and the government was paying for the GIs. And when I got here, it was 46, and there really wasn't an inorganic chemist. There were a couple of graduate students doing something that probably you could call inorganic chemistry, but the kind of inorganic chemistry that that we did, and the kind that Henry Taube did and got the Nobel Prize and so forth, wasn't. There wasn't anybody doing anything like this. And now when I write things, and since you guys would be experts, tell me, everybody talks about the renaissance of inorganic chemistry. They say Bosolo is one of the guys involved with the renaissance of inorganic chemistry. But doesn't the renaissance mean that you're coming back to something that had already been done? So I'm inclined to call it the birth of inorganic chemistry. And I point out that the gestation period in the U.S. was a hell of a long one. And so I've been referring to it as the birth of inorganic chemistry. And to know inorganic chemistry now, no one would believe that it is where it is, compared to where it was in the 40s and so forth. I mean, it's made such jumps that it ranks now very close, almost the same as organic chemistry, whereas organic chemistry dominated chemistry. Mm-hmm. And that's the situation in terms of my early chemistry.
So you come to Northwestern, you're an inorganic chemist, there isn't much here, so who do you talk to, A, at Northwestern, and B, out there?
Well,
in the immediate post-war period.
Yeah. Here, when I came, Northwestern had positions for about 70 faculty. I'm not saying I don't mean 70, I mean six or seven faculty. And I think that there were six of us who arrived at about the same time. And we used to get together in an office about this size and have lunch together. Eventually that developed into a lunch that we now have together in this large conference room. But in any case, we would talk about things, and even occasionally about chemistry. I mean, we'd talk about the football games and the baseball games and so forth, but we would also occasionally talk about chemistry. And when chemistry was talked about, at that point, inorganic chemistry really was not considered to be all that significant. And so Ralph Pearson, whose training was in kinetics and mechanisms of reactions, he was working on organic compounds with some of our organic chemists and helping them do this kind of chemistry. And I used to give Ralph the business, how about coming on board, two of us, because systems that I could, that I know we should be studying, no one else is looking at. We could do what you're doing on organic compounds on the metal complexes, which are a class of compounds, and almost anything we would do would be original, publishable, useful as far as students are concerned, till you get their PhD thesis approved, because that also would be readily original kind of work. And that's what happened. I mean, it just kind of happened that Pearson then did come on board, and the two of us together really did what we couldn't have done individually. I mean, he needed me, I needed him, and we arrived here just at the right time. And that's really how that part happened.
How do you get from that to being at this first Gordon conference?
I look at that. I have a whole pile of things that I haven't thrown away. I'm about to give the archives some things and throw things away. I think I put that right on there, right at the top, right there. Is there? Let me see what that is. Does that look like it?
GLC.
Yeah, that's the Gordon conference, but I like this though when I saw it. Now let me see the other one, on top of the other one. Does that look like it's been
Xerox?
Oh my God, that's... believe it. You're looking for two sheets which are obviously things that were Xeroxed, and I thought I'd put them right out on top of everything. Now let me see if I can work my way over there. Let me. No. Well, I'm sure you're going to get these things, but I really wanted to show you that, because I'm sure it's something you people would want to see, anyway. Well, not inside this.
Look at that one.
Is it,
and it's old looking. tell you what's on it, but I should have it sitting there.
It's not this, is it? It's not that.
Absolutely, it is that. Good for you. There's another paper. Well, yeah, it seems people get it. Okay, if you look at this, you'll see inorganic chemistry, because the Grödner Conference started long before inorganic chemistry, but it's talking about inorganic chemistry wasn't all that important. And in order to start a Grödner Conference, I think they had a rule that you had to have in excess of 50 people for it to pay for itself, and would not have been possible to get 50 inorganic chemists to go to the Grödner Conference, because there was no funding. They would have to pay their travel, their registration expenses themselves. So inorganic chemistry, as you will see here, and I'm sure they're going to give you what you want from the Grödner Conference archives or whatever anyway, inorganic chemistry seems as though, and this is the way I remember, started in 51, and it tells you exactly what happened here. Started with the discussion, not any lecture, but just discussion of some areas of inorganic chemistry. Then this moved to lectures given, and the first lecture given is me, if that is believed. That's what it says here. And I can't remember that it was the first, but I think that this is correct. That was the first inorganic lecture given. There were these discussions before my lecture, however, but the discussions had nothing to do with my lecture. And after my lecture, then there were additional lectures. And the inorganic conference was every year, and each year inorganic chemistry began to be somewhat more important, so that there would be people who wanted to attend, and the number went from 50-ish up to 100 fairly readily, and it kept at that and even got a bit larger, and I think at one point it was intended that you would have no more than 150, and not too many less than 150, because the schools that they were in needed that amount of money to carry on these Grödner conferences. And the conference is still going from 51 till now, and it only missed 1 year. I don't know that I should tell you this, or I don't know that you should use it, but there was the chairman, and we didn't know this, of course, the chairman was having trouble working up a program, getting speakers and so forth, and I don't know that it was Alex yet. It was before Alex. Well, it might be. Yeah, maybe it was Alex. Anyway, yeah, it was Alex. In any case, Alex would call him and ask for the program, he would say, I've got one or two more people to contact, and Alex would say, look, we always publish these in Science, I think it is, mm-hmm. and I really need this information, because Otherwise, it wouldn't be able to publish. Well, it went this way, and the end result was he had become an alcoholic. Gordon conference, since it was so late before they found out.
So it was actually a gap.
There's one year. I can't remember what year it is.
Can I go back to this first conference,
yes,
Brad, and the idea of having a Gordon conference on inorganic chemistry? Do you know whose idea that was? Was that John Baylor?
Oh yes, I think John Baylor had much to do with it, but there were others as well. Baylor and Moeller at Illinois, and I don't know if you let me see that. It will remind me. But yes, people like Bob Perry and myself, we were there also at that time. But Baylor. Oh yeah. Well. People also that were involved right early on is Martel, who is almost dead, but not quite. Anton Berg, he was an old timer and doing good work, and Schoen at MIT, and Gady Washington. These people were a bit older than Bob Perry and myself, and they were much more involved. We were, of course, being helpful and got involved ourselves as a result of their asking us to, I guess, or wanting to. So Perry and I have been very loyal. In fact, that's the reason I put that picture, you know, frame there that is supposed to indicate that I've been going through all these 50 years or so. And Perry and I haven't missed very many of the inorganic working conferences. Well, I certainly missed a couple because I was dying with pneumonia for 4 months. I was not able to do this. And I guess one other time I had a commitment abroad, and it was not going to be convenient to make that commitment and go to the Gordon conference. So I've only missed two or three, I guess. And even now, where I just can't really do this, and I don't do any other traveling, I enjoy going to the Gordon Conference and have made arrangements. Carl Storm, who's the director at the moment, and his group make sure that I have my generator, an oxygen generator. They make sure that I have a scooter, both of which I need, of course. And they know that I no longer have funding because I haven't been doing any research. I haven't had a lab for the last 15 years or so. And so he picks up the tab for all this registration and everything else, and he calls me a consultant, I guess. So I'm a consultant, and he's been very kind about it. And the reason I like to go to these is, first of all, I was editing a small journal, Comments on Inorganic Chemistry, and this journal was not all that prestigious journal, but it was certainly adequate and certainly a respectable journal, and it was very helpful to young people who were making up their resume in terms of particularly putting it as part of what they accomplished, doing and so forth, in their attempt to get tenure, so that they would do this, and I would tell them, for example, look, when you write your article for comments on inorganic chemistry, you have to write a definite proposal of work that you want to do, and you can certainly edit it, modify it somewhat, and send it to comments on inorganic chemistry. They were all very thankful, not all, I guess, but most of them were very thankful, and the journal did very well. But I finally got tired of this, and a year or so ago, I recommended to the publishers that they contact John Fackler. He does this kind of thing, and Fackler was very pleased to take it on, and that means that I'm no longer doing it. I got more than enough to do, and I have some difficulties in keeping up with it. But what I'm doing now, just to show you guys, is this. There's Civic Department in this. It's Nobel Prize laureate, and a couple of others. Nobel Prize laureates. And what it is you take your reprints of articles that you published, and they will fix them up, make the book, and they got several volumes in this series of volumes, and most of them are Nobel Prize laureates contributed.
Now, if we jump back again to this 1951 conference, Fernelius is listed as head of it. Who was he? Tell us a little about him.
Okay. Fernelius, he did research, but it really never attracted all that much attention. And that's okay. He was still contributing. And he certainly was, along with Baylor and his people, interested in starting the Gordon Conference. So yes, he should be mentioned in history.
Where was he? What was his?
Oh, he was at Penn State.
Okay. Yeah. And was it thought right away that this would become an annual conference, or was it, let's hold one and see what happens?
No, I believe that all of us who really were involved in getting it going, as I say, inorganic chemistry, just starting, so there were not that many people doing inorganic chemistry. Also, the people didn't have all that much funding, so they couldn't really get funding for travel, for registration, and so forth. So it started slowly, but I think we all thought that it would continue, because the Gordon conferences, the other ones, were continuing, and we knew that they were all pretty actually format. The format is still the same as you've heard about, I'm sure, where they have the talks in the morning, take the afternoon off, go play golf in my case, and others play tennis, and others climb around the mountains and so forth, whatever, and then they have an evening session. And that's a very nice format. The other thing that's very nice about it is that it is limited to 150. I don't know if you guys have ever gone to the American Chemical Society annual meeting. There are millions of people running around. You can't find anybody even if you want to. Here, limiting it to 150. And the great arrangements are that, in fact, some of these school, boys' school, now that I'm handicapped, of course, I don't do that, but you share a room and one, you eat in the cafeteria all together, and if you want to see someone, it's very easy to make arrangements to see them some afternoon. If you want to talk to them about your research, or you can write a paper to them together sometimes. You can do that. So that it is kind of unique in that respect. And those of us who go to conferences where there are thousands of people like this arrangement, also invited are some of the very best chemists, inorganic chemists, doing really outstanding work. And maybe the other people want to attend. This is a big shot. So they have a few of these people sprinkled in. Now they also have had for several years posters. Mm-hmm. And so graduate students and others put up their posters. So it's been going all these years. And it's still going. In fact, now it's gotten so large, I think, that I heard a couple of years ago, a fellow who was chairing it got 180 requests. We had a hell of a time cutting it down to 150. So, at the moment, there's no problem. In inorganic chemistry, yeah. I don't know what anything about the others. You know.
Had you, when you went to that first conference, had you ever been into anything like it? Did it remind you of anything? I mean, what did you think of this?
It didn't really remind me of anything, because in those days, that was in 51, and I started, started publishing, was, but in the late 40s and early 50s. So I got involved because of Baylor and people like this, and the fact that there were so few inorganic chemists. So, and those of us who were younger got involved also once we came on board, writing letters to the few inorganic chemists that we knew that we were doing it again, and really pointing out to them how much we really needed to support for the conference, how important it was going to be, and so forth. We didn't know it was going to be ending up the way it has. We didn't know that inorganic chemistry was going to be where it is today, You know, all the stuff that my friend never told you about is inorganic chemistry. So much of all we have, seriously, we do have some of the very, very top people. And the research they're doing is on inorganic systems. I mean, they're doing physical inorganic chemistry, most of them. And thinking that it was zero when I arrived, in 46, and having a look now, it just is frightening to realize what's been going on. Fortunately, the president, provost, these guys, are very supportive of the chemistry department. They know that the chemistry department really pays for itself practically, because the guys go out and get these grants. And I don't know what percentage the university takes of those, but it's surely 15% or so of the amount that they get. And also, every once in a while, they are able to get some like a government agency to actually put a lot more money in it, buildings like the one you went through this morning happened in that way, really.
One of the interesting things about this 1951 conference is from the start you have industry representation. What was the interest of industry in organic chemistry at the time?
Yeah, that's a good question. And there wasn't all that much, but the so-called rare earths were being used in different ways, I guess, in incandescent lighting, this, that, and the other. And there was a laboratory, a commercial laboratory, that was actually separating these rare earths, difficult to separate, in order to get the ones that would be active and do the job.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't all that much going on.
The first day, Fred, is devoted to Crystal Grove.
Yeah, that's.
And there's a Bell Labs guy. Is that already germanium silicon? Is that what that was about?
Yeah, but I don't remember too much about the commercial stuff that was going on, but that certainly is true. Growing these crystals, and again, when they grew the crystals, they had a special need for them. And so you can see that there are three or four or five people there who are in industry, the rest of us are in universities.
Did you know beams, that whole first day, it was Crystal Grove, did you know beams about that?
Not really.
you know Beams, that whole first day, it was crystal growth. Did you know Beams about that?
Not really. But that's the other thing about the Gordon Conference. You may not know Beams about it. And in fact, after we got going, what we tried to do is have maybe three topics, two or three topics, so that even though you're doing research in topic number one and don't know Beams about topic two and three, it was felt, it still is for that matter, that you should be aware of what's going on in topics two and three. And one way of doing it is to go to the Gordon Conference. And one of the rules is that if you go to the Gordon Conference, you're expected to stay there the full week. And staying there the full week exposes you to that area of chemistry that you know little or nothing about. And it has worked out very well. It also is true, I think I mentioned this already, it brings in outstanding people that younger people look up to and feel it's really worthwhile to, for example, have lunch with such a person, because they're having meals together. Sooner or later, if you want to meet one of these people, it's easy. And these people are expected to stay also all week. I think that rule is broken down. At least of inorganic chemistry, because the Gordon Conference started quite early.
That territory of crystal growth, which was in inorganic chemistry, did that did solid state and semiconductor stuff come out of?
I think it must
inorganic.
Have, yes, that's an area I know little or nothing about. But I think that's correct.
There's another day was spent on electron deficient compounds. I'm not sure what that would be or what that would mean. Do you know what that was?
No, I am not sure what it was either. But there are compounds which are electron deficient. They're supposed to have maybe 18 electrons, and they only have 17 or something like this. And the ones that are electron deficient are generally much more reactive than the ones that are not. The ones that are not are more stable. So there are examples of electron deficient compounds.
Can you give me an example or two? I'm just wholly ignorant about what.
Well, I'm not all that knowledgeable about the examples. But in an organometallic chemistry, there are compounds we need to work with that are not all that stable. And in the process of going from one compound to another, you have to go through some system. And what you do if you go through an electron deficient compound, that makes the reactivity such that the compound is capable of reacting in the direction that you want it to.
Another day was spent on inorganic fluorine compounds. What's sexy about inorganic fluorine compounds?
Well, fluorine is a very corrosive and very reactive element. And even now, you have to be careful how you work with it. In the Manhattan Project, for example, all of these places that were centrifuging the gases, uranium fluoride, to concentrate the isotope that is a compound. It's the isotope that's needed to make the bomb. The isotope of the uranium, for example, And they did this by having it make a gas with chlorine, so that the chlorine is so reactive that that's something that can be done with fluorine, but it can't be done with chlorine, for example. So there are things that chlorine is used for. This is the one that's best known, I guess.
So that that day might have trenched onto atomic energy, radioactivity, those sorts of
territories. No, I doubt it, because early on, people were talking about things like that. Maybe some of the stuff that Manhattan Project was still classified. This fellow, George Cady, was at the University of Washington, I think. And he was one of the few people doing chemistry with fluorine. However, I should really say that, because people who in the Manhattan Project were doing fluorine chemistry, and these people, when they left the Manhattan Project, many of them went into academic positions, and in their academic positions they continued to do fluorine chemistry. So all of a sudden, fluorine chemistry became quite important. A lot of things done.
And then the other day was on coordination compounds. What's sexy about that?
Well, the sexy is the fact that I do it. No, seriously, coordination chemistry, since you guys are in history, in fact, I should tell you about this. Way back when, in the early 1800s, I guess, or early 1800s, there was this guy, who made a lot of these compounds. They are very interesting, they have different colors and so forth.
This is Werner?
No, that Werner, I'm getting to Werner. This is Jorgens. S.M. Jorgens. S.M. Jorgens in Copenhagen made these compounds with his own two hands. He analyzed them and everything. And I spent a year at Bamley and I on sabbatical and worked in the same lab as S.M. Jorgens. He had a whole cupboard full of these compounds. And Jorgensen had a theory, which was referred to as a chain theory, and used that theory to guide him in making the compounds. And he was very successful. And it took about 100 years or so before Alfred Werner came along. And Alfred Werner was trained as an organic chemist, but he was intrigued by all these colors that these coordination compounds had. And so he, and also intrigued by the fact that people didn't understand too much about them. And so he started having a look at them, and finally ended up with this coordination chemistry theory. And that was 100 years later, really. The first compound made, I guess, was Tesseret, who was a Frenchman. I don't know that he ever published another paper, but he did publish this paper, and it was 1700 in 89 or something like that. And Werner's thing was in 1930, so he got the Nobel Prize, so it must have been 1900s.
Why did you get into it? Were you in, did your Roman passport wasn't on coordination?
No, no, not at all. When I went to Illinois, I found there that the professors they had, most of them were very good. And it however happened to be organic chemistry. And they only had two or three inorganic chemistry. And I, when I did my undergraduate work, it was just a teaching place. And there was a member of the faculty who really kind of looked after me, and we got along very well. And he was an inorganic chemist. And so when I got to the University of Illinois and had to decide, I decided that I'd like to be an inorganic chemist, even though these giants of organic chemistry were all there. And all the graduate students practically were doing organic chemistry. And I talked to, as graduate students do, talked to three or four of the inorganic chemistry faculty, and in every case I came away feeling I didn't want to work with such a person. And then I did find John Baylor, who I know was a good chemist, and he was a good guy, and he really interested in his graduate students. And that intrigued me so much that I went to work for him. He was an organic chemist who became a coordination chemist. And you know, the coordination chemistry now involves almost, well, really involves mostly all the metals. These groups, you know, attach themselves to the metal. And, might hold two groups, might hold four, might hold six, and so forth. So there's an awful lot of work that goes on, such as work that's being done here, you know, in terms of what we're doing.
So John Baylor, as an organizer of 51, got a day on coordination compounds.
That's right.
And put his star graduate student on first.
Well, I don't know how that happened. But I didn't even know that when I was writing the book. Fortunately, I hadn't thrown everything away. So I looked through what I had and came across this. And the way it looks like that's when inorganic chemistry started. And it also looks as though I gave the first talk on inorganic chemistry. But you guys can find out, because I'm sure the Gordon Conference will give you all the historical information that you need.
Who were Martel from Clark and Douglas from Penn State? Were these Baylor students or who?
No, they were. They were almost Baylor's age, I guess. And Martel is in bad shape at the moment. Fernelius passed away some years ago. Of course, Blade Baylor also passed away a few years ago. So,
did coordination compounds become a staple subject in the inorganic conferences? I mean, was it one of the subjects year after year?
Yes, I think so. In some way or other, it might not just have been called coordination chemistry, but in the chemistry that was being discussed, you can see that there is coordination going on. In fact, now they a very important field, a very important area, that is bioinorganic chemistry. So the chemistry that some people are doing, are on biological systems, for example. Even work that I did, I haven't gotten to that part of what I'm going to put in here, but we ended up with finding out that cobalt was a synthetic oxygen carrier. Nobody had ever noticed that before, and we started working on it. And before very long, we ended up with something like we call it cobaglobin. It's like it's like the biological system itself, instead of having iron in it, you have cobalt in it. So, and that's coordination chemistry, just like the hemoglobin is, you see. So,
inorganic, that's a separate conference that came out of inorganic.
Oh, yes, inorganic chemistry now has gotten so large that there are people who are suggesting that we no longer should have a inorganic order conference, because inorganic chemistry now is bio-inorganic chemistry, it's organometallic chemistry, it's several areas of inorganic chemistry, and we should just simply have Gordon conferences in these special areas. Now, some of the old timers, like myself, and I keep mentioning Rob Perry because he's been doing Folsom. But anyway, like myself, keep insisting that no, we shouldn't go and have these specialized Gordon conferences, even though it is true that organic chemistry could break itself up half a dozen different conferences. And our argument is that we'd like to use this Gordon conference to make the point, and also to have people get exposed to different areas of inorganic chemistry. And at the moment, we're still doing inorganic chemistry in addition to the specialized inorganic or non-organic.
In the early 50s, when people speak of inorganic chemistry, and certainly before that, it's a field dominated by German scientists.
Oh, yeah, sure.
In the early 50s at the Gordon conferences, are people coming from Germany, or are you really drawing people from North America?
Well, we didn't have any money to finance anybody from abroad, so we weren't getting all. Occasionally we'd get one or two, and eventually this did pick up. But when I was a graduate student, for example, I didn't know any German, but most of, as you say, most of the inorganic chemistry was being done in Germany, and they were making compounds. And in my research, there were times when you would like a compound that had been made, and they would publish in journals which are in German. So you would have to do the best you can if you wanted to make that compound. And it got to be possible to do that, even though I didn't know any German. All I could do, though, really, was to go to the experimental, in any case, that's what I wanted to do, and recognize some of the words, mix this with this, and then give the formulas for the reactions, and so on. But that's what they did, and it turned out that they were really concerned with making compounds, and they couldn't care less about how or what happens as these reactions take place.
Mm-hmm.
I think I made certainly mentioned in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I got in this area working on chemistry because as professor looked at me, and at that stage I was a young man in my laboratory. We do real chemistry. We got into the philosophy of chemistry. I was about 35 years old at the time, and that prompted me to do the chemistry in that area, which turned out very nice because nothing had been done, and we were able to publish and graduate students were able to come up with new original work for their thesis. So, yes, a lot has happened. I mean, since
were a lot of grad students, or were any grad students coming to the early inorganic conferences?
I think practically none.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it had to do with travel expenses mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. Even the faculty people, we would write letters to them and kind of beg them to come if they possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And they would make the sacrifice and come. But I don't think there have been, there may have been occasional graduate students. Whereas now, graduate students come and I think they pay less of a registration fee. And in fact, Gordon Research Conference now has developed into a real business like you guys, where they have quite a bit of money. And they give this money to graduate students to offset. They don't pay all the expenses, but they mm-hmm. certainly pay enough of their expenses to make it attractive to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's attractive to them for other reasons. In fact, when they're almost completed their research, and they're probably even doing postdoctoral work, but want a academic position, one way of doing it, and it works quite nicely, is to go to a Gordon conference and meet someone from some university where that university has an opening
mm-hmm.
for a new faculty person, and this young person and the other can get to know one another,
mm-hmm.
and the older person in the department can also have conversations with him, find out what the younger person is interested in doing mm-hmm. and how capable he would be
mm-hmm.
To do this. I've helped two or three of my students over the years exactly that way. I would introduce them to someone from such a university, and by the time the Gordon conference was over, they got to know one another very well.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys did indeed get positions at universities where they had talked with the faculty members. So there are lots and lots of things that the Gordon conference does.
Did you hire people to Northwestern on that sort of method?
I just don't recall that we did it that way. The answer is, I think not.
Mm-hmm.
I think not. I think what we did was we'd go to meetings, and we would be impressed with what was being presented, and the person who presented whatever it was, research that he was doing, and then if we two or three of us in the faculty agree that this person is doing very nice things and he understands what he's doing and so forth, we would invite him to come and give a seminar.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, the entire faculty would have a chance to talk to him and listen to his seminar. And if that all went well, that's the person that we would make an offer to.
Right.
So a variety of ways, of course, coming up with new faculty.
Speaking with the inorganic conferences, did you end up chairing any?
Yes.
Yeah.
If I recall, I chaired at least a couple.
Mm-hmm. What was your experience like in terms of deciding who would get to come and how to send out invitations?
Well, it depended first on what was happening in inorganic chemistry, which was a primary interest, and who was doing it, and so forth. So you sit down and work out a program, and then send it around to a couple of people to have a look at it and to make suggestions. No, I wouldn't have this. You probably forgot to do that, and so forth. Mm-hmm. But the person who has the chairs is competent enough to really come up with a program with little or no help, I think. And it's their responsibility to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I say that one year that wasn't done, nobody paid attention to the chairman, and by the time they needed that information, it was just too late.
Mm-hmm.
So they canceled the court conference.
Right. Yeah. Now go ahead.
Well, you guys appreciate this, I'm sure. The Gordon Conference, when I was, I think, chair of the Board of Trustees, I don't know whether it was exactly that, but anyway, when I was on the board, I was looking at all these applications, you know, for starting a new conference, and we try to evaluate these and so forth, and depending on that, the nature of the conference and so forth, you either approve it or don't approve it. And a number of people going to, or the number of conferences, not the number of people going to, the number of conferences before I left had reached 100, almost exactly 100.
Mm-hmm.
And I've made the point that I shouldn't go much beyond 100 if they're going to keep these conferences the way they had them.
So you mean in terms of the number of participants, not the number of conferences?
No,
the number of conferences.
Number of conferences.
Okay.
You know, there are lots of different areas of chemistry, so that they were mm-hmm. conferences in different areas. And, however, I also, in order to, it was quite apparent that people were going to these conferences who were not even chemists. They were physicists, or they were something else. And since this is a conference is supposed to be a chemistry conference, I also try to point out that that was happening, and some kind of arrangement should be made to prevent that from happening, at least to a large extent. And in order to do that, the application form, I convinced people on the board that we should have a question, maybe quite, and it turned out to be about the third question or something on the application, is how many research chemists are working in this area. And some of them had no chemists working in this general area. There they were physicists, you know, and they're biologists.
Mm-hmm.
And I was suggesting that they shouldn't have this. Well, everything's gotten to a point where now the Gordon conferences are all over. They got one or two places in Italy, they got something in Germany, they had one in London. When I was writing the book, I wrote a short paragraph about the Gordon Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew they were having these conferences and setting them up in different countries, different places. And so I called up Carl and said, would you please read this part of the autobiography, because it has to do with the Gordon Conference, and tell me if there's anything wrong with it. And he said, gee, this is great, except that we have just established a new conference in Singapore. And I said, Singapore? Christ, there's no chemist in Singapore. I was there, you know, once at the university, and I had a seminar. There was a handful of people. But, of course, there are little islands around or whatever, and people have no opportunity to have these kinds of conferences.
Mm-hmm.
So they started a conference in Singapore. They had conferences every place. And that was not intended, but that's what's happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the inorganic conferences, I gather they were initially very much sort of self-funded out of the dues and what people paid for it.
Oh, yeah.
And then at some point the Air Force, the Office of Scientific Research, OSR, kicked in.
That's right.
What's the background behind that?
Well, I don't remember exactly how that happened, but in those days, the atomic energy, so-called atomic energy, people were putting some of their money into research. And the Air Force Office of Scientific Research was also had some money to support basic research. And I was one that was involved. And this guy, Denny, who was a member of the staff of the Air Force people, and a couple, two or three others, Doc Perry and a few others. I don't know exactly how it all came together,
mm-hmm.
but at some point the Air Force was giving the Inorganic Gordon Conference funds to help support the conference, and it came to a point where it was routine, where it depended on the conference, depended on getting that much from the Air Force. And that was very helpful. And then later, if you read that chapter in the book, I think it pointed out that that had to be stopped, because by that time the Gordon Conference was pretty good shape,
mm-hmm.
and could even kind of support itself. So so-called atomic energy people were putting some of their money into research. And the Air Force Office of Scientific Research was also had some money to support basic research. And I was one that was involved. And this guy, Denny, who was a member of the staff of the Air Force people, and a couple, two or three others, Doc Perry, a few others. I don't know exactly how it all came together, but at some point, the Air Force was giving the Inorganic Burden Conference funds to help support the conference. And it came to a point where it was routine, it depended on the conference, depended on getting that much Air Force. And that was very helpful. And then later, if you read that chapter in the book, I think it pointed out that that had to be stopped, because by that time the Burden Conference was in pretty good shape and could even kind of support itself. So that was okay.
In the 1950s and 60s, were you going to other conferences, or always just the
just gone to the Inorganic Conference.
Would you occasionally meet and talk with chairs of some of the other conferences?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What sort of things would you talk about in those days?
Well, we would talk about, when we were talking about research, we would talk about the research that we were doing, you know, graduate students and so forth. So sometimes you had things in common, sometimes you didn't. So it always was an interesting exchange. Things were at that time. And since there was more activity in the early 50s, inorganic chemistry, I guess the conversation was largely organic chemistry. So we were there.
So, when you were doing the conferences in the 50s into the 60s, George Parks was running the show.
No, he had just been put in jail or whatever now. It was right at the at that period. And Alex was the fellow in charge when I started that.
So you didn't really interact with Parks at all?
No.
Right.
I'm sure that because we've talked about Bob Perry, list. I don't know whether you've already talked to him or not.
Yeah.
But he was on the board. He did do some of the things that needed to be done. And that's when it happened.
Yeah.
I came on the board, I guess, a year or two later.
Right. Yeah. Now, how were relations with Alex Cruikshank?
Relations with Alex were absolutely superb. Alex is a really fine person. He's a real Scotsman, you know. He wouldn't spend a dime if he could do it with a nickel. So he would always go to these schools, and they would be trying to get more money, and expect him to raise the registration fees or something like this. And I guess he knew how to handle them, so he would threaten them. If they did this, you may have to cancel one or two of the court conferences. But he and I really knew each other through a professor who was at Illinois when I went there as a graduate student, who I guess didn't get tenure and went to the University of Massachusetts, this guy. And Alex did his master's degree. I think Alex has a master's degree. I don't think he has a PhD. And with this person. And I knew the person, and so that, I guess, helped me and Alex become rather friends. And I'm sure you probably already heard about it. After seeing me last night, you know about it. At some point or other, because as I say, Alex didn't spend money out to go to the conference. I don't know whether it was because of Parks and stuff, but he did. And I think not. I think Alex is just that kind of a guy. At some point, anyway, we started having lunch together. Those of us who were on the board or had been on the board and Alex would have lunch. And we'd all contribute to the lunch, pay for our own lunch. And at some point or other, someone said, Alex, you can certainly justify this to the IRS in terms of our getting together and discussing the business of the conference. And so that's the way this happened with inorganic chemists who had been on the board or were on the board. And every year we went out to work. It's always on Tuesdays. It's still going on.
It's during the week of the conference.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Tuesdays. Whoever's director takes us out to a good seafood place. Packer and I have one martini too many, I guess, but I like seafood, you know, and it's, and I don't get it here.
So who goes, who's at that lunch today, last year?
Well, last year I was there, and I don't think Harry Gray attended, but Harry Gray has gone to it a couple years ago when he was involved. And Fackler was there. He had been on the board. And I, Hirsch, was there. And Fackler, I think, had invited this Frenchman. Bordeaux, you know, they have all that good wine to give a lecture.
Did you say Norm Hackman's name?
Norm Hackman. Well, I didn't say his name. What's the term? Tell me a little bit about him.
No. I wasn't sure how to. Bob Paris at that lunch, isn't he?
Not this year.
Yeah, but he would do that.
He would have been there, but he had some other commitment, and so he hadn't done a couple of years.
It sounds like the senior debenture holders. Would somebody as young as Mark Ratner be there?
Oh, sure. Because he's on the board. Mm-hmm. Anyone who... Well, it just works out that way. Anyone who is or has been on board of directors of the Inorganic Conference would attend that Tuesday luncheon, and it's a good spread, you know. They give us a good lunch. So hello.
Yes, sir.
Good. All right. Thank you.
How about Alan Cowley?
Alan Cowley, yes. He's the guy at Texas, at the University of Texas. Yes, he was there this year.
What,
and he did it then.
What's his connection? I mean, what was his...
Well, he just attended a conference.
Right.
But he had been, I don't know when, but he had been something, Board of Trustees. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether he had been the chair. I think he had also been the chairman of the Board of Trustees at one point. And that's the way that luncheon gets together. Sometimes there only have maybe three or four guys. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are 8 or 10. So that you never know how large it's going to be. It depends on who the people are that attend that particular conference.
Mm-hmm. And the director would be there. Carl would be there, or Alex would have been there before.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. This year, Carl was not there. And he appointed somebody to be there in his place. He was starting another conference, I think, in Japan or some damn place. So he wasn't at that conference. Otherwise, the director, Carl or Alex or whatever, would always be there and pick up the tab and so forth.
Mm-hmm. You talk about topics for the next year.
Yes, that's talked about. Mm-hmm. Last couple of days of the conference, you know who the chair is going to be for the following year. And the chair passes around a sheet of paper asking you to indicate what you think the topic should be. So, not everybody responds, obviously, but people do respond. So the chair at least has a feeling for what the group thinks should be conference the following year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they get some good suggestions in addition to what they themselves think should be.
Do people compete and lobby to be chair of the conference, or do they try to avoid it?
I don't think, have you guys ever heard of Al Cotton?
Mm-hmm.
Have you? In what context?
If you switch the tape before, Rob, I'll tell you. Why do you ask?
Well, because you asked, really, people, election year for becoming chair and so forth. Al Cotton had this young lady at the University of Texas A&M, very fine, very good chemist, and he wanted to make her a chair the following year. And so he was lectionary bar camp. And then that Thursday night that we vote, someone has to say a few words about the person who you're going to vote for. I mean, you have two people.
Mm-hmm.
There is somebody who talks about one, somebody who talks about the other. Anyway, the situation was one in which this guy who now has a Welsh professorship just recently, Ted Rice, because I don't remember the name, I can't remember. But anyway, also, I didn't mention, when I was young, I used to as well. People, after the Thursday night session, either go out and look at the posters now, or go out and have several beers or whatever, even our liquor and whatever. And Barney, I guess, was there, and he's an outgoing person. And since it was known that Al Cotton had a candidate to be chair, people went around to one another and did lecture there for this guy from Rice instead of the gal from Texas A&M. But however, that evening, that there was going to be this voting. I don't know how it began, but it did begin. Hal Cotton was very much involved. He and two or three other guys, he always frightens people into doing what he wants. They said that there had never been anybody nominated from the floor. And that's true. Previous ones had a few people, and that's it. But myself, again, mentioned Bob, and so forth. Two or three other people point out, what the hell do you need when you have such an election? You've got to ask if there's any nomination for the floor. Mm-hmm. Nobody's ever had such a meeting without asking. It is true that in previous years, they really, nobody was nominated for the floor. Well, anyway, we finally did get our way instead of Cotton normally got his way, except that two or three of us really insisted. And his choice did not win, and she did not get nominated. And she would have gotten nominated because she's a good chemist, a very likable person. Later on, she said to me, I think I would have been nominated, except for the talk that was given as soon as it worked. And you know, or maybe you don't know, but Bell Hunt is a very embracing guy, very opinionated. Bell Hunt has some good kills, but he's a bad person.
Has he usually attended?
Oh yeah, not all that much. No, but he does attend occasionally. Yes. He and I have a child on him. Because over the years, people have either telephoned me, sent me a letter or something, and indicate, because they've been kind of coerced by Cotton, is this the way that inorganic chemists behave? What the hell is going on here? We got this lousy letter from Cotton and this, that, and the other. And I have to point out, oh no, this is just this particular individual. And I have letters in there in that file that are unbelievable, simply because I just don't know. It's something that he needn't do because his chemistry is quite good enough. But his personality is terrible.
Have there been over the years, from time to time, real personality clashes, operating difficulties, and just keeping the show on the road?
Well, the moment it's Fred Basolo and Al Cotton, everybody knows that Al and I don't get along. And I'd like to think that all the good guys are on my side. And really, the people that are on Cotton's side, by and large, are his former students and postdoctorates. And he is known, I'm sure this is true, to frighten his students, postdoc, into nominating him for this, making sure that he gets this award or that award. In fact, in our department, one of his students, very, very famous now, but when he arrived here, he'd only been here a couple of years, and departments nominate people to get honorary degrees, and he sent a nomination for an honorary degree for Cotton. department, you always would discuss people in terms of honorary degrees if they wanted to appoint someone that year. And so they did not, the department did not select anybody to nominate for an honorary degree. When the honorary degrees came out, there was F. Albert Cotton. And this young man, Cotton, was told, if you don't do this, I'll never write a supporting letter, this, that, and the other. And, of course, the internet hemisphere, all of them hate Cotton. So we managed to be out of town. We managed to be someplace where when we should have been here, it had been this other thing. So Cotton has, Cotton and I are well known, not the best of friends.
What's been with the inorganic conference over the years? I mean, it's been very, very successful, it's been very long running. What have been the difficult aspects of making it work over time?
Well, at the beginning, I mentioned that the difficulty was, of course, the people who attended were largely financing themselves. They didn't have, there just wasn't funding in those days. Whereas now you have funding and you have a budget for travel and so forth. So that was a difficulty in starting. But as soon as funding became available, that aspect was there. And it's amazing how I don't know of any real serious problem in inorganic chemistry, except the one that I just mentioned. Other than that one, we never had any problem. At least, you know, and I attended almost all of them. People get nominated, they get elected, you know, on Thursday, and you got to get chaired. And, oh yeah, we have, every other year we have an academic person and an industrial person. That way, people in the industry in LA are not ignored, and so forth and so forth. That works out real well, because I think also conferees like myself and others really get quite a bit out of the conference, which was arranged by people in industry. And I'm sure that the people in industry get quite a bit out of academic, or basic research.
What about the person who's nominated for chairman but isn't voted for chairman? I mean, don't you end up with a lot of people with bruised feelings?
How you expect that to happen? The two people that are not you usually end up with two people being nominated, and you don't nominate the person until you have contacted him to see whether he or she is willing to serve as chair. So they would say yes or no. They say yes, then you go ahead, and there would be a vote. Well, first of all,
But then, so someone discovers they really love Joe more than they love me.
Yeah.
Doesn't that person tend to say, well, I, in that case, I won't go to the Gordon conference anymore?
Oh, I see. If the person doesn't win the chair, would he ever go to the conference again? Just boycott it. I haven't paid much attention to that. But I don't think, I don't think anybody other than Al Cotton would do something like that.
Does someone typically, if they're put up and they don't make it, do they then tend to be put up again in a couple of years?
Oh yeah, sure.
So
yeah, yeah, usually that's in fact almost the foregone conclusion that if you put up and don't get the chair like the year after that, the chair would, it would, since you alternate, you know, there'd be at least 1 year where it couldn't be, be dominated, because it's not whatever it is. This person's in academic work, and if it was industry, and so forth. So, but other than that, no, I don't think so. I think that in general, everybody realizes that only one person can be and win the election on Thursday night, and there's hard feelings, I don't think.
Cary Gray told us that when he was chair, he threw a wine party for the group. I mean, is there a tradition of chairs doing something special?
Well, I don't know that Harry financed it, maybe, but I don't think so. Yes, on Thursday evening, there's always a lobster dinner, and people looking forward to the lobster dinner can have a drink. Can't bring any alcohol in the cafeteria, but you have your case before you go to the cafeteria and have your lobster. So Harry Gray, for example, was responsible for this plaque I have there, because he was, I think, at that point, the chairman of the board of trustees. And Harry Gray is quite outgoing, very active. He does, of course. And so that kind of thing had never been done before. And I don't think it started a precedent. It was just out there.
Are there special traditions or things in the inorganic conference? And such, you mentioned the lobster lunch,
well, I can't think of anything specific. When I was not handicapped, I liked to play golf. I'd bring my golf clubs. I liked to play tennis. I'd bring my tennis racket. Other people would do the same, depending on what their interest was. And if I understood your question correctly, I think if advantage was taken in the afternoons to do this. In my case, Denny Elliott, who was the fellow that you talked about in the Air Force, and Bob Berry and myself played tennis in the morning before breakfast. They didn't play golf, but I would play golf in the afternoon, tennis in the morning, golf in the afternoon. So, I was much younger and could do those things. And other people would do other things. For example, the people who knew that I would be there, because I attend all of these things. Some of them were young golfers and golf. Much, much better than I do. I never played tennis well, I never golfed well, but I enjoyed drinking. And these kinds of things became a tradition, perhaps, and you knew who was going to do what, and very soon you get involved in some kind of tradition such as that.
What happens if I'm not a very sporty type?
Then you'd have other ways of getting together and carry on conversations of chemistry if you want, watch it on television, a baseball game, football, I don't know, whatever people do. People who enjoy walking around, there's no real mountains usually, but there are, you know, things here. Mm-hmm. Interest, I guess, walk around. And so they would do that. And others would go drive into town, I guess, do some shopping or whatever. And I guess as a result of all these variety of things that are available, sort of traditions grow among the individuals, I guess.
Do a lot of people have family come and be in the area?
Well, they're not a lot, but they're... Yeah, certainly are some. Yeah.
So you had your family in the area, but not, you were away for the week, typically.
That's right, yes. My wife came with me up back. No, we didn't bring the children, but the children, their grandmother nearby, not you. And later, Mary stopped coming, and I went alone.
And most people would be on their own.
Yes, I don't think they ever had their name. But they could have, if they wanted to. But almost all of them.
It's just a group of fanatics together.
Well, you could say so, I guess. Well, look, let me ask you one question. You guys are doing this history of country. Do you have a chemist? If so, what kind of a chemist?
We have a couple of people on the staff with chemistry PhDs, yes. One's a polymer chemist, one's an organic chemist. We don't have an inorganic PhD, I regret to say.
Foundation recognized worldwide, globally, that you're collecting all this information on campus.
Oh, yes. Well, for instance, we have the archives of IUPAC, which interestingly, wonderfully, were transferred to us and given to us. They were temporarily in Oxford, England, but they said CHF is a better place.
Well, the reason I ask some of these things, I have a compound that was made out years ago, more than 100 years ago, there made by us in Jorgens.
You have some of his?
Yeah, and I also have some of Alfred Williams. And you know, that's rather interesting. The fellow, let's see if I have it. Here's what happens if you get old. This is a Basolo medley. And lecture.
This is annual.
Yeah.
Now.
And a picture drawing after I die.
Where's the phone? What was I about to tell you?
That's very fine.
What was I talking about just before?
About the Werner.
Yes, that's interesting. You probably know about it. The one of his people, one of his students, was also, as myself, was making tour of universities, I guess, in Switzerland. And there's Switzerland's where Alfred Werner was, and so forth. Anyway, they had a collection of Werner's compounds. And what you call it, Steve Lippard, very outstanding chemist, decided he does a lot of things. And one thing he does is that people use X-rays to determine structures. And he took a pretty good sample, just like David said. But Lippard decided to do these structures of this crystal compound. And not only did he do it, but he published it in Chemistry with Alfred Werner's name on it.
Fantastic.
That's kind of interesting.
Fantastic. Are those samples here?
Yeah, they're in there.
What's your plans for the...
Well, I was going to ask you later on when you get to a point where I'm going to give some of the things to our archives when I was asking whether you want
them. Oh, we'd love to have those. We'd love to have those.
Okay, keep that in mind.
Great. Thank you. Great.
So, just to finish, the X-ray structure showed that Werner and his people had, without X-rays, without anything, just guessed, really, at the structure of this compound prepared. And it wasn't right on, it wasn't perfect, but it was close to being Werner. Just showed how competent those people were.
That's neat.
Werner, I guess, was an alcoholic. So they showed me where to stop at this problem. It's an open secret, I guess. He died of syphilis, I guess. All these kinds of love stories about Werner.
Now, with the inorganic GRC conferences, were they always held up in New Hampshire, or have they moved around?
They moved around, yeah.
Have there been ones in California where...
Yes, there have been.
Oh, right, and there's one in Ventura. Did you notice a difference to them based on the location? Did it matter where it was held?
Well, I didn't notice it particularly. I think the reason we don't know is there are funds. Really, the reason it was done, started with, was that the people on the East Coast were beginning to bitch a little bit because they were held over on the West Coast, and the people on the East Coast felt that it was expensive to travel for the conference the occasion they also, and that's how it got started.
Mm-hmm.
And now usually it's in Newport, but it's a beautiful place, nice place to have it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's been there for quite a while.
Now, into the 60s and 70s, you kind of got into the GRC governance. Did it start with the S&S committee, scheduling and selections?
My getting into it?
Yeah.
Well, that's what happened. I guess I got nominated, and this is the way it happened. Well, everybody can tell this. To the council.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the council, I certainly did something to, as you say, reviewing proposals and so forth. And then got a board of trustees, eventually became chairman of the board.
Right.
That's generally what happens.
Was bioinorganic starting around that time, or is that a little later?
Oh, no, yeah, that's right. It is a little later.
Oh, okay.
Bioinorganic chemistry. Well, now it's one of the very important areas,
yeah,
of course,
yeah,
of inorganic chemistry. But it certainly wasn't involved that time at all. I mean, early on.
What were some of the newer inorganic subfields that were going around?
There weren't all that many. As a matter of fact, that's why I say it, the organic chemistry. And, however, there was the beginning of organometallic chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And these metals, which form coordination compounds, get involved and interact with organic molecules, and you can build nice structures of such compounds, and some of them are more interesting than others. However, there was never any real intent at that time to build, to make things that are of commercial interest, the way it is now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our chemists now are rapidly becoming millionaires because they can do things which are applied, and they occasionally come across something which they patent.
Mm-hmm.
And some chemists have Look, I'm going to have to go to that lunch. Let's see what time is.
It's just 11:30.
We've got another 15 minutes.
They'll be picking me up around there, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
You joined the council in 1970, can you talk about issues and concerns in your time in the governance? Did everything run along smoothly, no problem? Was it a piece of paradise?
Well, I don't really recall things all that well these days, but to the extent that I do, I don't recall that there was really any problem. And serving on the board we sit around and discuss what's going on, what should happen, what shouldn't happen, and so forth. But I don't recall that there's any some of us our opinion, which is different than someone else, but we always resolve it without any difficulty.
How about relations with AAAS in those years?
Even now, community hasn't been all that much relation. AAAS, for example, several years ago, they left the U.S. AAAS chemistry part. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that anybody really even belongs to it very much, but the only job that I had to do, the person that wasn't like it, was to make sure that you had a program, a chemistry program, and that's what I did. I got together three or four people and arranged the one day. A session,
mm-hmm.
And almost nobody came, even though the topics were of interest. Almost no one came because there were almost no chemists there.
Mm-hmm.
So, there was all that much interaction.
There's some mention here of Snowbird, of being at Snowbird. Was that just for a board meeting?
That was the. It's probably called Snowbird. It's outside of Salt Lake City, in Utah. It's a ski, it's a mountain in which people ski in winter. And I guess I'm not a skier, but apparently it's well thought of. People who used to be. And in the summer, it is used to have groups there who wish to use the facilities, the houses where you ski and so forth, and walk around. It's nice to look at and so forth. And Bob Perry, who lives there, suggests. He was on the board, and at the same time I was, and I suggested that why don't we have a next meeting at our place, which would be very nice, and we all agreed with you that we should do it, and we went out there and had a very fine meeting. I just don't know what the board is doing these days in terms of having meetings.
The inorganic conference moved to Brewster in 82. Was there any particular reason for that?
Yes, there always is. The inorganic conference that when it started was New Hampshire, but that was named the place of
New London?
Yes, I think it was perhaps New London.
Right. Colby Sawyer College.
The New Hampton one.
Oh, was it? I'm sorry.
New
okay.
It was in New Hampton.
New Hampton, yeah.
And it was interesting. In this little town, there was one store, grocery store, over by the morning paper and whatever. There was one barber shop. The barber would come in once a week and so forth, and that was about all. So you had to participate, really, in the conference. However, at some point or other, when they began to have additional conferences, other people had better facilities, that we did, the inorganic chemists began to look around and suggested Brewster is a very nice place, which it was, with the lake there. So we managed to move to Brewster. I don't recall exactly how that was done. The conference that was there probably dropped out or went to another location or something. And it was a good location, and we were staying there. And then, all of a sudden, there's a Japanese group, I guess, who came, as far as I understand it, and offered Brewster more money.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to move elsewhere. But we ended up at Newport, which is a hell of a lot better than Brewster. Newport is fantastic, so I'm sure we're going to stay there. Or they're going to stay there until they get kicked out.
Something, here's a letter in this file, Fred, that puzzled me because it refers to the proceedings of the conference. And what would that mean? Saying that
I'm going to give you that file.
That would be wonderful. Saying that everyone is a bit tired of hearing Marx, Schrock, Burkhardt, Holm, Wright and Gray, Cotton, etc. Stirring up trouble. Did you often do that?
No, not really, but I think that's true, and it was true at that time, and it's still true to some extent, but not only at the Gordon Conference. Yeah. People. I mean, the younger people down below. Well, the people up above, you're talking also. Yes. In fact, just when I was present in the ECS, writing occasionally editorials in our journal, American Chemical Society, I had gone to a Gordon conference and heard this person talk about this research. It was very good. And since I guess I might have been chairman, I must have been, I guess, chairman of the Board of Trustees at that time. And, come in! Hey,
you still look like you're working hard, guys.
Yeah, we're doing all right.
Okay. If you can remember how to get back to the department office, which. Actually, when Sunbin comes to get Fred, he can show you how to get this. And so when you leave the department on this, people will tell you what you want to do. But you want to get on this long haul, go all the way east as far as you can go. And there's a small exit. Walk out the exit, and this cab should be in front of the building. Now, one other thing. In case it's not there, let me give you the phone number, because you've got something to be here.
Yep.
It's 847.
Mm-hmm.
251.
Mm-hmm.
0303.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So Sunday when he comes to get you, can take these guys up.
He probably usually comes just
meets you outside.
Through the door here.
From here, what's our directions?
No, you can come right back here, of course. And then
your office is over there, isn't it?
No. Don't know where my office is. That's much.
No, I mean the
department office. Yeah. Yeah, we have to go outside and then back in.
You have to go up one floor.
Yep. No, it's fine.
Well, sure. Yeah. We speak of
very next meeting. Thank you for all the presents,
Mark.
Thank you for all these presents. And I'm delighted we're working together. It's really neat. When I come to Philadelphia, I will call you.
Please do.
Do you know any terrific single guys in their early 30s? Let me know. Fred knows my daughter. She's pretty, she's nice, she's smart, and she's funny. But she's married.
That's what happens.
Fatherhood will get you.
That's what happens.
Thanks, guys.
Okay. Yeah, this guy, I guess, will be coming to get me at 12 o'clock. We got 15 minutes.
Yeah. I think
and I'm going to give you that file, of course, because I have no use for it. And of course, you guys are going to the Gordon Conference, or will do so.
Yes.
I think they've kept all the records and so forth.
Yes, yes. No, we've got a lot of stuff from. New Hampshire, yeah.
I guess the question I would still ask is, looking to the future, what do you think is really important to the vitality of scientific research, and especially in inorganic chemistry?
Well, it's hard to predict the future, you know. It'd be great if we could predict the future. I think that it's becoming more and more clear to the general layperson, even, that chemistry is contributing in many ways. And to the extent that it is, we keep hearing about, for example, new medication, which takes care of this and takes care of that. I think that the lay people would come in.
Excuse me. Come on in. A real quick question.
Sure.
Are you going to do lunch today?
Yeah, and Son Ben's going to take.
Okay,
me.
You've got an arrangement.
Yeah,
okay.
Thanks a lot.
All right, I was just checking.
No, no, that's fine.
Sorry.
So I think that there's a real future for chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
However, chemistry has a problem, and it hasn't totally broken out of its problem. And that is chemistry occurs in a variety of different kinds of compounds and so forth. And it is oftentimes referred to as a central science,
mm-hmm.
because it gets involved in a lot of these things. And to the extent that it gets involved and makes the major contribution, people don't really hear about chemistry because it's not used. I remember the first time I heard person called talking about genetic engineering. He was doing chemistry on DNA and so forth. And it's called everything genetic engineering. At the end of his talk, I said, "Hey, Tom, what the hell is this engineering stuff? It's genetic chemistry. Everything you told us about had to do with chemistry. It didn't have to do with engineering." But the word engineering has caught on. So chemistry takes a little bit of a beating because of that. On the other hand, I think it's beginning. That phase is beginning to improve. Where it's going to go in terms of anticipating developments, I just don't know. But it is really making its mark, even more so.
But the future of the GRC?
Well, I don't know. The future of the GRC is just it's so large now, I would be worried about it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I would worry about the fact that it is, they've got conferences all over. And not all of these countries, chemists in all these countries, are happy that the Gordon Conference has done this.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard a couple of comments anyway, a couple of countries say, "What the hell, we can have our own damn conference. What do you guys want to have? Conference?" and so forth. So I think there is some resentment. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I don't know, I'm no longer involved. As I say, I was trying to keep the number at some reasonable number, like I tried and failed. I was trying to keep it at 100. It was roughly 100 by that time. And instead, I think, you know, some people think bigger is better. But now, the Gordon Conference has gotten so big, and I think financially it's in real good shape.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason that they have money to bring speakers in from abroad, or at least to supplement their travel expenses, and likewise pay expenses for graduate students, or at least partial, and speakers as well, and even the consultants, which I am going to have lunch with. So they're not hurting.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, a lot of people think that bigger is better, so it may continue to grow. I have no idea. But you know, also, I guess I also wrote an editorial when I was president of UCS, the explosion in publication, and in likewise in conferences and lectures that were given. And I made the point that I heard this lecture, I didn't mention where, following week I heard the same lecture, and then the lecturer had to go to Germany where he gave the same lecture. And I wanted to make the point that these damn lectures, you know, are given by the same person in different places. I even pointed out that not only could I anticipate what he was going to say, I could even anticipate the jokes that he was going to tell you, you know, because he told
me. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the chemistry keeps growing, and molecular biology now, I think, seems to be very good. And nanochemistry, nanoengineering, that's the building we have, actually. Mm-hmm. And that's the big thing, chemistry at the moment. So that it's hard to anticipate what's going to happen.
All right. Well, I don't know if any...
I think we've very excellently covered a lot of good territory.
Yeah. Right.
So that's great.
I hope so.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
As I say, I really only was involved with the Gordon Conference years ago when I was involved with the Board of Trustees. Oh, I still get involved occasionally by giving advice and my opinion on things. But no longer the way I used to be.
All right, well, why don't...